Thank you for coming to our fourth and final panel, last but certainly not least of the day, which will focus on how the Constitution affects, permits us to change how we separate powers. Moderating this panel will be Judge Britt Grant, who serves on the United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit and has done so since 2018. Before that, Judge Grant served on the Georgia Supreme Court as well as the State Solicitor General in Georgia. She's a graduate of Wake Forest University and of Stanford Law School, where she was the FedSoc president. And she clerked for then-Judge Brett Kavanaugh on the D.C. Circuit. We're grateful that she's moderating today's panel. We also have Professor Sharif Gurgis, an associate professor of law at Notre Dame Law School. Professor Gurgis's work lies at the intersection of law and philosophy in the context of jurisprudence and constitutional law, and most relevant to today's discussion, perhaps, is his seminal article, Living Traditionalism. He's a graduate of Princeton University, of Oxford, and of Yale Law School, and he clerked for Judge Thomas Griffith of the D.C. Circuit, as well as for Justice Samuel Alito. We also have Professor Lawrence Lessig, the Roy L. Furman Professor of Law and Leadership here at Harvard Law School. He teaches in the areas of constitutional law and contracts. He previously taught at Stanford Law School, where incidentally he was Judge Grant's con law professor. He is a graduate of the University of Pennsylvania and of Yale Law School, as well as Cambridge University in between those two places. He clerked for Judge Richard Posner, and as well as for Justice Antonin Scalia. And last but not least, we have Professor Steve Sachs, the Antonin Scalia Professor of Law here at Harvard Law School. Professor Sachs came to Harvard a few years ago from Duke University Law School, where he previously taught. He's also the faculty advisor to the Harvard Federalist Society, and we're grateful for his work there. He's a scholar of civil procedure, of constitutional law, of legal theory, and of originalism. He's a graduate of Harvard College, the University of Oxford, and Yale Law School. So Judge Grant, I'm sorry we've stuck you with three Yale Law School graduates. He clerked for Judge Stephen Williams on the D.C. Circuit and for Chief Justice John Roberts. So Judge Grant, I'm going to turn things over to you. Thanks so much, everyone.
Thank you, Ben. I'm so grateful to you and the other Ben or Bens who have done so much planning and the rest of the FedSoc chapter here. This is especially exciting because, as you said, I was the FedSoc president at Stanford. And so I remember encouraging people to come to this conference. And I think it's only grown and become more robust in terms of the students and the great panelists. So thank you all, Harvard, for your support and all the students who've taken your time to be here. I'm particularly excited to be on this panel. As was mentioned, Professor Lessig was my con law professor. So maybe I can ask him a hard question or two for once. We'll turn the tables a little bit. Professor Sachs and I were on the D.C. Circuit clerking at the same time, so that's fun. And I've got a lot of admiration for the scholarship that Professor Gurgis has already contributed. So what a great panel and honored to be here. During this symposium, we have highlighted both the theoretical and the practical importance of the separation of powers within our constitutional structure. Distinguished panelists have considered the unique and complicated nature of the vertical separation of powers between the federal, state, and local governments. We've discussed the evergreen question of the administrative state's role in or destruction of the separation of powers. And we have addressed the risk of judges overextending the authority of our own branch in ways that may impede the lawful execution of the other branch's powers. All of these discussions understandably have come with the backdrop of the Constitution's separation of powers being the right mark to hit. But what if it's not the right mark, and what if it's not the right mark right now? A fundamental thing about our Constitution, whether right or wrong, intentionally or unintentionally, is that it's incredibly hard to amend, at least as a formal matter. So our three panelists today have interesting and important contributions to the discussion about ways to create legitimate change within our Constitution. And I, for one, am excited to hear what they say. So let's get started. Professor Gurgis.
Thank you. I'm super grateful to be here, very honored, a little bit embarrassed when I saw the list of panelists. I sent it to a friend and I said, one of these things is not like the other. And he said, yeah, one of you is a federal judge. And I'm happy to go with that description of the outlier. So the discussion, the topic is change in the law of separation of powers, and what are the options for change? And my bit is to defend the idea that at least in some areas of separation of powers, it is possible to have a change in the constitutional law without a change to the text, without convincing the court that it got it wrong in a precedent, and even without running through the other typical stare decisis factors. Now, why could that be? because I think those areas of separation of powers law are based not on claims about original meaning, but on practices. And not practices that are just judicial precedents, but practices of non-judicial actors. And practices of non-judicial actors that can't be assimilated to precedent, where it's not clear that deferring to them is simply deferring to another actor's judgment. So that's what I'll mean when I talk about traditionalist cases. So I'll say a little bit about what those cases look like and what examples of them are. Something about why I think whatever rationale you have for relying on those practices, it's equally a rationale for updating the law on that issue when the practices change. And then I'll say something about how the practices could change in the teeth of a contrary precedent. So on the first issue, there are some classic examples, and different scholars have talked about this in different guises. Some talk about historical gloss or traditions, so Kurt Bradley, Mark DiGirolami, and others. But one locus classicus is, one recent one anyway, is the case of Noel Canning, where the question was whether the president had lawfully appointed members of the NLRB under the recess appointments clause, because the recess of the Senate at issue fell not between two sessions of the Senate, but within a single session. There were a couple of issues, but that was one of them. And the court said, these recess appointments are okay, not because of something about original meaning or judicial precedent, but because of practice, and very late practice. Late practice constituting basically 75 years in the 20th century. Because for that long they've been doing these recess appointments, they must be okay. So a certain kind of case, a traditional separation of powers case, will say if a branch has always done something, it's probably within its constitutional power to do it. The second kind of case says the opposite, or the converse, says if a branch has never done something, that's a basis for thinking it lacks the power to do it. And a salient recent example from around the same time is NFIB versus Sebelius, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, where five justices just barely said that Congress cannot compel commerce in the name of its power to regulate commerce, because that oversteps its power under the Commerce Clause. And why? One of the reasons was they've never done it before. And if they've never asserted that power, that's some reason to think they lack that power. The most salient recent case is Trump v. Anderson, where the court said that states probably lack the power to enforce Section 3 against federal officers because they've never asserted that power. But it turns out that these aren't just recent cases. I think the traditionalist cases on separation of powers span every era of the court's history, and every issue in separation of powers, and justices of every stripe. You can find cases of this kind falling under all three of the articles defining the branches of the federal government. So within the realm of executive power, it's not just about recess appointments, but cases about the president's power to remove federal officers. It's not just about that, but it's about the details of the presidential pardon power and the pocket veto, about when and whether presidents can use executive agreements or memoranda or other actions that don't have Senate or congressional consent to bind third parties or the states. Under the Article I, under the powers of Congress, you have cases not just like NFIB about whether Congress can compel commerce in the name of regulating it, but also, you know, cases defining the fine-grained aspects of the Congress's power to grant and extend copyright protections, or their power to make justices ride circuit, or to make them make judges serve on in extrajudicial tasks like on the sentencing commission. In the realm of fed courts, or Article III, you have a bunch of cases about the meets and bounds of personal jurisdiction, sovereign immunity, even questions about, for example, which federal claims can be heard in non-Article III courts. So in every one of these areas, and you can find originalist as well as non-originalist justices making arguments and signing and writing opinions in every one of these areas that rely on post-ratification practices, the things that Congresses and presidents have been doing without protest by the other. Why do I think that whatever rationale you've got for this, it's going to entail that the law should update with the practices? Well, one counterargument would be, look, there's nothing special or magical going on here. We're just looking at practices as evidence of original meaning. And people who think original meaning should trump will think that no matter what later changes in practices happen. The problem with that in a lot of these cases is that the practices that are being cited long post-date ratification. So there's not really good reason to think that they're evidence of original meaning. Sometimes there is. So this is not separation of powers, but in Marsh v. Chambers, for example, the court says the Congress that gave you the First Amendment also led its sessions with legislative prayer, so prayer must be okay under the Establishment Clause. But in a lot of cases, that's not the kind of practices we're talking about. In Zivotofsky, the court is looking at the powers of the president to define, to recognize foreign powers that arguably began only with the Wilson administration. In TransUnion, Justice Kavanaugh for the court writes an opinion defining Article III injuries in fact based on the practices, partly based on the practices of state courts in the 20th century. All right, so it's not just original meaning. Then you might say, okay, but it's a kind of precedent. We should defer to it for the same reason that we defer to judicial precedent. It's just non-judicial actors. The problem with that is that we defer to judicial precedent when and because the judges have hashed out the legal issue. Because then we say, well, deferring to precedent in that case strikes a balance between having the law settled and getting the law right, because at least someone tried to get the law right. But in dozens and dozens of these cases, there's no evidence that the non-judicial actors ever hashed out the issue. The court never cites a debate about the constitutional question. So you can't be deferring to anybody else's judgment. That argument for deferring to practice and leaving it in place doesn't apply. So what else is there as a basis for relying on these practices? Maybe a kind of Hayekian argument that the practice stuck, so it must have some social value. But then, of course, if the practice changes, you have the opposite inference. Or a Burkean argument that the practice, even if nobody was thinking about it, reflects a kind of accumulated wisdom of many minds over time. But again, then if the practice changes for long enough, the accumulated wisdom points in the other direction. Or a kind of departmentalist or democracy argument that at least if you're going to have the judges go beyond original meaning, you might as well have them go beyond in the direction that the democratically accountable actors have pointed to. But again, if the democratically accountable actors switch, then the democratic argument points the other way. And there have been cases where longstanding practices flip. Noel Canning itself is talking about a practice of recess appointments that happened twice in a 130-year period and then was ubiquitous for the next 70 years. Myers, about presidential removal power, was looking at a practice that existed for 70 years but then was displaced for another 60 years, and so on. So the practices do change. Now, the final question is exactly how can you leave them room to change? Well, sometimes the separation of powers doctrine based on traditions is a permissive one. Like, the president may make these appointments under the recess appointments clause. And in those cases, if the actor has a change of heart and for long enough refuses to take the action out of a constitutional judgment, then it's easy to see how the practice can change and the law should change with it. Sometimes the actions by which these different actors can register their judgments, like president vetoing a bill, will be unreviewable by the courts. And so the courts can allow that and then take it into account when they have a case that does appear before them. Sometimes there are soft law means. So Noel Canning itself cites soft law, just statements of positions on the law by Congress House resolutions and so on. And those would remain open to even after the court had spoken to a particular separation of powers issue. On the president's part, signing statements, veto statements, and speeches to Congress have been cited in some of these cases. They can be cited again to cut the other way. And then there are hard law options for resisting an existing separation of powers doctrine. And Zivotofsky, which again is about the president's power, supposedly sole power to recognize foreign powers, the court said, of course, Congress can't interfere in this, but if they really wanted to, they couldn't do it directly, but they could, for example, use the power of the purse to, you know, refuse to pay for ambassadors to the country or something like that. And that sort of indirect attempt to interfere in the exercises of power of the other branch would be another way for the practices over time to change. So, of course, the existence of a precedent of this kind of traditionalist precedent on a separation of powers issue, distorts the traditions and practices that it was trying to enshrine, because its very existence will make it at least harder for the other actors to change their behavior. But it doesn't make it impossible. And where it's not impossible, where the practices do change for long enough, there will be no argument sounding in originalism or deference to precedent or otherwise that we shouldn't let the doctrine change with it. Thanks.
Thank you. Professor Lessig.
So in the 10 minutes that's mine here, I want to talk about one of the very many things that I believe that most who share my politics do not believe. And that's that we need a cross-partisan Article 5 convention movement for many amendment purposes, including amendments concerning separation of powers. And this is actually a topic that's quite appropriate for this particular room. 13 years ago, in this room, we had an extraordinary conference about the Article 5 convention movement. We called it the Con, with participants on all sides, left and right, pro-convention and anti-convention. Yet the only real progress that came from that conference was that Mark Meckler of the Tea Party Patriots came to believe that a convention was indeed needed, and shortly thereafter helped launch the Convention of States movement for an Article 5 convention, hence the affection I received from people on the left. Yet, on my side of this metaphorical aisle, there hasn't been any such progress for a convention. A decade ago, an extraordinary movement of young people pressed to get the states to call an Article 5 convention for the topic that motivated them, campaign finance reform. Within 2 years, they had succeeded in getting 5 states to join the call. Common Cause then made it its cause to block that campaign finance movement, getting 2 of those 5 states to rescind their call and stopping every other state from taking it up. Thus has the Article 5 movement on the left stalled. Now, at the core of Common Cause's argument is a claim made by Robert Reich in 2018 that continues to be made by people like David Super today. That's the claim that the precedent of our founding means that a new convention could have the power to change the rules governing ratification of any amendment. As Reich puts it, quote, convention delegates could hijack the process and change the ratification process itself, tossing out the 38-state requirement. Now, the basis for this argument goes something like this. The framing convention went rogue. Rather than propose amendments to the Articles of Confederation, it proposed a new constitution. And rather than adopt that new constitution according to the rules of the Articles of Confederation, rules that required 13 state legislatures to agree to any amendment, the convention proposed new rules permitting 9, not 13, state conventions, not state legislatures, to ratify the Constitution. This precedent, Reich, Super, and Common Cause insist, means that a convention convened today could have the same power to change the rules for ratification. Now, this argument, however effective in stopping Article 5 calls, is, I want to suggest, obviously absurd. But to see why it's absurd, we have to be a bit more careful with the history that's said to give a modern convention the power to change the rules of ratification. Now, many, of course, disagree with the claim that the 1787 convention went rogue. Let's bracket that argument. Whether it went rogue or not, it is certainly true that the mode of ratification was not the mode envisioned by the Articles of Confederation. So how was that difference actually achieved? How begot, to borrow from the Merchant of Venice a bit, how nourished? Because what's perfectly clear is that the convention itself didn't pretend that it had the power to change anything. What the convention did was to send its work to Congress and recommend that Congress send it to the states proposing this different mode of ratification. And this Congress did. The articles notwithstanding, Congress instructed the states to hold conventions and declared that it would consider the new Constitution ratified when 9 state conventions signed up. Now, we could spend the whole conference talking about whether that Congress had that power. But the critical point for my purpose is to ask you to ask yourself whether you think our Congress has that power today. Let's make this very concrete. The convention movement for a balanced budget amendment is very close to the required 34 states. Some think it already has that number. Some say, given the plenary calls that have not been rescinded, we're but two states from 34. Regardless, it's not crazy to imagine that in the next 4 years, there will be enough calls to obligate Congress to convene a convention to propose a balanced budget amendment. Now imagine Congress does that. But on the first day of that convention, some tragic gun violence event transpires, and the convention is moved to put aside its balanced budget amendment and to take up the repeal of the Second Amendment instead. But imagine the proponents of that repeal recognize that there is exactly zero chance, look it up, zero chance that 38 states would ratify such an amendment. So the convention recommends to Congress that Congress declare that it will consider the amendment ratified if the amendment is supported in a national referendum. And imagine Congress creates such a referendum, and imagine 60% of Americans vote to repeal the Second Amendment. Okay, now, literally, is there a single person who believes that Congress has such a power? The Constitution expressly says that any proposed amendment must receive the support of 3/4 of the states. Is there any plausible theory of constitutional interpretation with to say that that plain language could be ignored because of an ambiguous precedent from 1787? Now, I know lawyers are forced to make difficult arguments all the time, but could you really imagine a lawyer standing before the United States Supreme Court and saying, "Your Honors, Congress has the power to amend Article 5 on its own because our Constitution was ratified through a procedure that was inconsistent with the rules of the Articles of Confederation"? This, of course, is crazy talk. And yet it continues to be uttered in legislatures across the country as a reason not to take up the second path to proposing amendments, a convention. Now, for those who think our Constitution is perfect, as it is, or those happy that the exclusive mode of amending our Constitution remains the vote of 5 justices on the Supreme Court, all this might be fine. But for those of us who believe that no unamendable constitution survives for long and that this constitution requires real amendments, this ignorance, and it is ignorance, is disastrous. Whatever else we disagree about, we ought to at least be able to agree that the rules governing any Article 5 convention would be consistent with the rules stated in Article 5. Or that, quote, convention delegates could not hijack the process and change the ratification process itself, tossing out the 38 state requirement, even if Robert Reich says they could. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Professor Sachs.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for coming to listen now for the last speaker on the last panel of a very long day. I very much appreciate it. This is, in fact, I believe, the first student symposium of FedSoc that I've attended in person. I was somewhat of an indifferent FedSoc member when I was in law school. I didn't attend any student symposium later on. I was supposed to in late March of 2020, but there was other stuff going on then. But I am here today, and I am very glad to be. And today I want to talk about ways that we might embark on constitutional change with regard to separation of powers and with regard to other things as well through the formal amendment mechanism and in some ways revive Article 5 as a means of constitutional change. At this point, it has been something like a half century since Americans have proposed and ratified a constitutional amendment. That is the longest gap, I believe, we have had in our history, and I don't think it's a very good thing. I think that it makes life together politically very difficult when there is widespread desire for change that cannot find expression through formal means. And so it finds its way into the political system through informal means and sort of sotto voce and causes decisions that can't really be explained forthrightly all the way down to be nonetheless accepted. I think it would be a lot better for our polity if we had consistent, uniform explanations of how it is there can be an institution like independent agencies or like the Federal Reserve and so on and so forth. I think it would be healthy for us to have those debates on constitutional grounds, in some sense above ground rather than underneath it. But how can we do that with an Article 5 that's very hard to use? So there are a variety of solutions. One way would be to amend Article 5 through the Article 5 process and lower the threshold so that you only need half the states or 3/6 of the states or whatever you want to say, 3/5. The problem would be, 3/6 would be the same. The problem would be that, first of all, you have to do that through the existing system. And it is very unlikely that 3/4 of states are going to want to give up much of their power to let other states act in their place. Likewise, it's very unlikely that 2/3 of Congress will vote to let only half of Congress or some intermediate percentage of Congress act in their place. The minorities that are capable of blocking a new Article 5 amendment enjoy their ability to block an Article 5 amendment, and it would be very hard to persuade Wyoming or other states that they should give up that power in the future. It also would not necessarily make for better amendments. If you have, Michael Rappaport and John McGinnis have argued, if you think about the amendments that fall in between, that are on the margin between what ordinary legislation could get through and what you could get the 2/3 and 3/4 to get through, they might not be all good amendments or might not be very many good amendments. I often propose to my students in my originalism seminar whether we should amend the Constitution to allow for California style referenda, and most people say no. There is not a whole lot of disagreement about that point, even across political lines. And given that fact, it might well be that people don't want lower thresholds for formal amendment. They don't want to allow for literally anything that could be done with a smaller number of states or a smaller number of members of Congress. Another possibility, as Professor Lessig has discussed, is the Article 5 Convention. But there, too, there are some worries. One, there's ambiguous questions about whether it would be constitutional to have a limited convention, a convention that only decides particular topics. There are good arguments that I've heard on both sides of that question. But it would be very important to know, because many people might be willing to entertain a particular limited convention, but would not be willing to entertain the possibility of a convention that might revise the entire constitutional structure at once. There are also questions about what the voting rule in such a convention would be. Would it be by states, which obviously has certain partisan and demographic implications? Would it be by votes in the Electoral College? Would it be by population? How would such a thing be structured? And that would be an area of controversy. Moreover, there's the possibility that Professor Lessig discussed of the runaway convention. I agree with him as a legal matter. It would be very hard to say that the convention could come up with some new means of ratification and have it be constitutional. I think it would be clearly a violation of the Constitution. That doesn't mean it wouldn't work. The U.S. Constitution was, in my view, a violation of the Articles of Confederation, and it worked. As H.L.A. Hart said, at some points, nothing succeeds but success. And if you got a nationwide referendum that passed by 60-40, I think it's very likely that you would see officials start saying, look, the Constitution has just been superseded in this particular way, and we have a new regime now. And the fear of something like that happening, the fear of a runaway convention that exceeds its mandate and that nonetheless would get accepted by people later on, is one of the reasons why many people are hesitant about the idea of convening a convention that could claim democratic legitimacy in an unexpected way. So what can we do? Well, one proposal that I have floated, in the list of crank proposals that every law professor keeps in a desk, is to flip the order of Article 5. Pass an Article 5 amendment, which would allow a second way of amendment, not just Congress moving first and the state second, but allow 3/4 of the state legislatures to adopt a given measure, and then, if 3/4 agreed to it, send it to 2/3 of each House of Congress for ratification. Now, that would have the advantage of keeping the thresholds where they are. so that it's unlikely that Wyoming or the senators therefrom would be too worried about that kind of change, because it doesn't, in fact, liberalize the process of the amendment. It merely reorders it. It means that we don't have to have a sort of big bang of support of two-thirds of each House of Congress, something that's very difficult to get, before you can start sending that amendment out to the states. Instead, amendment proposals could percolate, in a sense. You could get five or six states saying, yes, we think this is a good idea, at which point other people would start paying attention. It would not change the criteria for getting a new amendment, but it might make more amendments seem like live possibilities, seem like things that are on the wall rather than off, and thereby revivify the amendment process without fundamentally changing the distribution of political power over constitutional change. Moreover, it is possible to imagine that such amendments would in fact allow for revisions to the separation of powers that are very hard to do under the existing system. Right now, if you need two-thirds of each House of Congress, it probably is not going to be an amendment that limits the powers of Congress. Moreover, even if you had an amendment that limited the power of the president typically will come from a party which has at least one-third of one House of Congress, and it's going to be very hard to get something like that through. Whereas if you have debate among the states where a yes vote doesn't immediately move it that much forward, it is more plausible to imagine that ideas will be floated and will eventually be seen as plausible candidates, even be seen as candidates that have a lot of popular support behind them, such that congressmen might be induced to line up behind them, notwithstanding their institutional or partisan interests. I don't think that's guaranteed. And indeed, I think there's a good reason to want Congress to stay in the game, not just because it would be very hard to get two-thirds of each House to vote to take themselves out of the game and to give it all over to states, but moreover, because it is a good idea to have somebody that is nationally responsible have to decide up or down whether this thing is moving forward. It's easier to see individual states making irresponsible decisions, perhaps, if their decision is merely one among many and they can offload some of the responsibility for the underlying amendment. So I do recognize the possibility that any liberalization of the amendment process, any change to the amendment process, might produce more bad amendments than good. I, for instance, think a term limit amendment would be a very bad idea, but it's nonetheless quite popular and would probably be one of the things that people would try under this regime. But I think that part of the cost of a renewed amendment process and a process that tries to formalize constitutional change is the possibility that the changes might not all be of the kind we want. But one thing to remember here is that constitutional change does not in fact require a supermajority. You do not need two-thirds of the American people to support a constitutional amendment. To get one through under the current regime or the one I'm proposing, you just need 51% of the people in enough congressional districts. You just need two-thirds of members of Congress and three-fourths of the states to be in favor rather than against. That means you need a broad geographic distribution of support for an amendment, not necessarily a supermajority in support. And I think that if that is what the current amendment process requires, flipping the order might make it easier for that broadly distributed majority to have its say. Thanks very much.
Thank you all. I think those are some pretty compelling ideas. I've got actually a lot of questions of my own, but I think I'd love to give any of you a chance first to ask a question of one another. I think those are often really fascinating. So you look like you've got one in your back
pocket. I got one right here. I completely love Steve's suggestion for an amendment to flip the order. I would say this could be a third path to amendments. I would suggest that actually the history of the convention movement is very close to that. In the context of the really significant amendments in our constitutional history, they were actually pushed by a convention movement. The 17th Amendment, for example, we came within, depending on how you count it, one state of having enough to call a convention, and that terrified Congress and led Congress to send an amendment out to flip the way to elect senators to the United States Senate. And that's because every vote for an Article 5 convention was, in a sense, a ticking time bomb from Congress's perspective, because it really mattered. When you got to 34, there was going to be some legal consequence to that. So that has the kind of political dynamic that you're describing, but it doesn't require three-fourths. It only requires two-thirds to get to that particular number. But I do want to suggest that we still lose something if the only mode of amending requires Congress to go along. I mean, this was Mason's point when he pushed the idea of the convention framing convention. Because, you know, his question was, what if Congress is the problem? You need a way of amending to fix the problem of Congress that doesn't have Congress holding ultimate control over whether that amendment passes. And so that's what I think the role of the convention has to be. And here's where I would just like double down on my quibble with this suggestion that the framing convention is precedent for fear about the current reality. Now, you're right. It's certainly possible that, you know, Congress does something and it's completely unconstitutional and everybody loves it and everybody goes along with it. That's kind of like the French model for changing the way the president was elected. Okay. But it's not right to say that, in fact, that's what happened in 1787. Because 1787's Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, didn't have a convention clause. The convention that drew our Constitution was crafted, in fact, outside of that process completely. And I think, as Yaleys, we all believe this, that's just an assertion of the fundamental idea that, of course, we have the right, we retain the right, as the Declaration of Independence puts it, to alter or abolish our Constitution. We can resume this authority, and that's what they did, in my view, in 1787. But if you did it under Article 5, you're explicitly saying, I'm not invoking that authority. What I'm doing is I'm doing it under the rules laid down. And if those rules don't work, then maybe we need to fall back to this more revolutionary constitutional system. And there are a lot of people now talking about that revolutionary constitutional move. But I do think there's a valuable place for a method for amending the Constitution that frees us from Congress's own corruptions, especially in contexts that, you know, I think most carefully about, which is like campaign finance or things like that.
So I would say, I think three things in response. First, I'm not proposing to abolish the convention process. You know, that could also be an existing possibility. But I definitely agree with you on the way in which flipping the order of Article 5 is application for convention-like. Indeed, I've often thought of this proposal something like a rolling convention, because the debate would be not in a single room in Philadelphia, but going on in state legislative houses all over the country, all of which would be looking to each other and proposing different language and sort of working out a consensus on a particular measure, to the point where the snowball built until even Congress thought they had to adopt it. The second thing I would say is that, to my mind, the real worry with the runaway convention is precisely this sort of revolutionary aspect to it. And I think it is very hard to know when that will happen. You know, it is very difficult, as John Harrison once put it, to sort of bottle the lightning of popular sovereignty. Article 5 tries to do it in certain ways. The Philadelphia Convention was not revolutionary ab initio. It was originally, if I remember right, an attempt to sort of propose some things that would then go through the normal process.
For about 10 minutes.
For about 10 minutes, and then the Virginia Plan shows up. It's like, nope, we're going in guns blazing. But the problem is, from that point on, it becomes revolutionary. And likewise, you could have a convention of states that starts off seeming like a normal Article 5 process, and then it's like, oh my gosh, that is not what we have here. And so I think it's the fear of that happening that makes it harder to use in the way that it might have been intended. And that's not an inherent problem. It's not an insurmountable problem. It's just a problem that makes me think it would be useful to have this other technique as well. And then the third thing I wanted to point out is just that the valence of kicking Congress out of the process has really shifted. If I remember right, there was a move in the civil rights era to sort of the counter civil rights era to allow for constitutional amendments without Congress in the way, the thought being that state sovereignty could be better promoted by having Congress not being part of the amendment process. And obviously that's a political valence that does not have the same kind of support nowadays. And so whether it's a good idea to keep Congress out of it is might just depend on the issue. My sense is that just as a political matter, it'll be hard to do anything that keeps Congress out of it. It'll be hard to get an Article 5 amendment through that would in any substantial way limit Congress's participation. And moreover, it might not be a good idea to let lots of distributed decisions in different state houses add up to a national change to the Constitution. We might want at least one stop on the you know, train route that involves somebody with national concerns making a single national decision. And you could do that through some sort of convention process, you could do it through some sort of electoral college process, but right now the one we've got is Congress, and it's hard to imagine themselves writing themselves out of that process.
I've got a question for Professor Lessig. What would you say if the concern is not that the ratification process would be changed, but that even within the existing Article 5 process, it would be a runaway convention of sorts in terms of radical change that those who first anticipated this convention wouldn't have expected? It sounds like you think maybe that is either worth the risk or not a risk. I'm curious what you think about that.
Well, if you first look at the actual proposed rules that have been developed by the state legislatures that have been considering how they would run a convention, those rules are pretty strict about the type of issues that can be considered. They say the only issues that can be considered are issues that 34 states have actually passed resolutions to support. And that rule is itself marked as unamendable. It's an unamendable rule. So it's not to say that you couldn't have a revolutionary convention that said, even though our rules say this is unamendable, we're going to amend everything. That's certainly possible. But I think it lowers the chance that you would have something that doesn't have broad support coming up as something that would propose. But I guess my ultimate position is, so what? It takes, if you concede that 38 state requirement is not going to go away, if you can't stop something that has 38 states behind it, maybe you're not a Democrat, small d Democrat, right? Maybe you're on the wrong side of the issue, right? And I think what we've got to embrace is the idea that we need a process that allows the democratic process, not the judicial process, to begin to evolve our Constitution for whatever the particular issue is. And the 38 state requirement, of course, across the globe is a pretty strict requirement. And so if that's the ultimate requirement, then I think that we just have to accept that that's a pretty sufficient requirement. Now, I also think, you know, I took the case to the court that tried to affirm the original understanding of what electors could do. Electors had discretion. 9-0, the court disagreed with me. But the silver lining in that case is that I think that delegates, both to a convention and certainly to a ratifying convention, could be constrained by law. So imagine something similar to what you were describing in state legislatures, but through citizen assembly-like structures that themselves debated like constitutional amendments. And the state law said no delegate to our Article 5 convention can support any amendment that doesn't have the support of, let's say, 60% of a citizen assembly, random representative reflective body. That would be another way to constrain the process to make sure that it doesn't, you know, propose crazy at least tied to democratic views. But, you know, it's the middle position that I think is ultimately the one we've got to come to terms with. 13 states can block anything, 13 states. And there's certainly solidly 13, so one legislature in one house in 13 states. And we certainly have stability on both sides to make sure that, you know, neither side's going to be captured by a system that allows that.
Thank you. Professor Sachs, I found myself wondering whether under your system there would be more of a risk that issue-oriented amendments would happen, where we've seen, you know, swells of popular opinion in this face of especially judicial rulings that went a certain way on constitutional issues. And for a time, people had popular views about, you know, what the Constitution really meant and wanted to change that. And I think those understandings shift over time in a different way, I think, than some of the more structural understandings. Do you think that there's a risk that your process would lead to a very specific issue-oriented, a longer constitution, a lot that looks like a state constitution maybe, or constitutions from other parts of the world that have less structural and more kind of substantive provisions?
I mean, it certainly could. Whether that's a good or a bad thing depends on what the alternative is. So if the alternative is, you know, as it's sometimes called judicial updating, might be like, I'd rather have the Constitution of Alabama than have, you know, a whole, sort of the Constitution being this very short document you can keep in your pocket and then walls of volumes of the U.S. reports. You know, so there are some intermediate things between there. Another question that one might raise is, should there be temporal limits or temporal minima? So some people argue we should require contemporaneous decision, like all of these people should agree within a 7-year span, because that's the only way that sort of the people all at once can make a decision. Some people say, no, it should be the opposite. It should be like you have an automatic waiting period, you know, to buy a gun or to amend the Constitution, that you have to, you know, enact something and Congress has to wait 4 years and then they can ratify it. And that shows that it's actually sort of survived deep discussion and might actually be, you know, a good idea. And so like, you can imagine structuring things one way or the other. To my mind, issue amendments are only bad if we think that 2/3 and 3/4 can be persuaded to sort of react the wrong way very quickly. I mean, maybe that's what happened with the income tax amendment. Who knows? You know, maybe it should have happened with legal tender cases. I mean, there are all sorts of different ways of thinking. You know, what was the where would this process have worked well or poorly over our history? And to my mind, it really just seems like if you've got that broadly distributed a consensus, you're probably okay.
Thank you. Professor Gerges, I know you had a lot of interesting ideas, and one question that I had was, if this traditionalism interpretive mode is harmful in these ways, why would you say we should alter how we think of it versus courts should get away from using that mode in the first place?
Yeah, so I meant to be agnostic on whether it's harmful or justified overall. It's ubiquitous. I've found dozens and dozens, at least 60, 65 cases where you can't slot the reliance on tradition as just evidence of original meaning, or even as, you know, what Bode, following Madison, calls liquidation, basically non-judicial precedent, where they hashed out the issue the way they did with the National Bank, for example. Okay, so one thing is, it's so pervasive that that's some reason to doubt that you could get away with eliminating it entirely. There are some cases where it's very hard to see what else the court might go by. So for example, there's a case called Garamendi, which is about whether the president can use, I think it's like executive agreements rather than treatises, to bind the third parties that are foreign nationals rather than, or foreign corporations rather than foreign governments, or something like extremely fine-grained question on which there had been no judicial precedent. Now you might say at the end of the day, well, all of these cases should just become a kind of deference to what the political actors have chosen. So maybe we can replace Thayer with all these traditionalist cases with that kind of deference to political action. But there are plenty of areas where the meets and bounds of an issue have to be settled one way or another, and to defer to political actors every time might seem to be to give them too much leeway. So if it could be done, that might be a reason to the implication that you should update the constitutional precedent that's based on it might be a reason to do away with it. But on the other hand, you could flip the point and say, because it's so pervasive, it's become part of our law of interpretation. It's what our courts have been doing and what it's been acceptable for them to be doing for long enough that it's totally kosher, and now we should just embrace the implications of it, of using it.
Do you think that, say, there are a lot of state laws post-Roe? Would you say, under your theory, those laws were a reaction in those states that people viewed Roe as unconstitutional, or an updated approach by those states of substantively what they thought was constitutionally appropriate?
Yeah, so there's dozens and dozens of cases in the rights setting that are traditionalist in this way. Under substantive due process, for example, the court has said that whether a particular activity is protected as an individual right depends on whether historically it was treated as a right by states and by various state actors. And Dobbs in footnote 3 says, maybe even under the Privileges or Immunities Clause, that's basically the same test for whether you have an unenumerated right, whether it's long been treated as a right. Now, there's a way of reading that where the state practice is not just evidence of what the states think the Due Process Clause means or what the states think Privileges or Immunities means, but that it's actually a tighter connection, that the state practice is what makes it the case that something is or isn't protected. And from that angle, it doesn't matter what was in the state officials' heads when they were passing these laws that were an attempt to resist the holding of Roe. The very fact that they were doing it constituted a kind of practice that the courts, when they're interpreting the Privileges or Immunities Clause, should rely on. But from this angle, basically, privileges or immunities, or under the precedent due process, is a fixed norm that points you to changing traditions over time for its applications. It says you're entitled to whatever the states have long treated you as being entitled to. And there's one reading of, for example, not only the parts of the majority opinion in Dobbs, but Justice Kavanaugh's concurrence, where they are resting some non-trivial weight on post-ratification practices. When Justice Alito for the court says, we're not just looking at 1868, that's the most important historical fact, but we're looking ahead all the way up until Roe was decided, and even then, two-thirds of the states had laws that banned elective abortion at all stages. When Justice Kavanaugh says, I'm focused on two things. One is that the text is silent, and two is that practice leading up to and all the way up to Roe rejected a right to abortion. There's some reason to think they're relying exactly on this kind of traditionalist argument.
Interesting. I've jumped in with many of my questions. I know you all may have more for yourselves.
Well, I have a question for Sharif, and I guess there are a few places where the Constitution itself might make that sort of thing relevant. So I'm thinking one place might be the Eighth Amendment. So John Stineford's theory of unusual is that it means not of long usage. So at this point, flogging is unusual, even though it was not at the founding. And so post-ratification practice matters, not because it sort of changes the Eighth Amendment, but that the Eighth Amendment standard of unusualness specifically looks to post-ratification practice. Some theories of privileges or immunities would say the same thing. They might not, as we were talking about earlier, Corfield might be exclusively backward-looking at all times, but it might be the sort of thing that looks to ongoing practice. I guess what I'm wondering on, not just sort of your observation of what people do, because people do all kinds of weird stuff, but, in your sense of like how the Constitution is properly interpreted, do we look to this subsequent practice only where the Constitution otherwise understood itself calls for it, or does it have some other role to play?
So I think the strongest argument in the case where originalism and traditionalism will exactly overlap are the cases you're talking about. And I think that where the original meaning plausibly points you to changing practices over time. And the Eighth Amendment and privileges or immunities, I think, are the strongest arguments. You mentioned Stineford's work on the Eighth Amendment. I think many, many people have written on privileges or immunities, including Evan Burnick and Randy Barnett, for example, think as an original matter, it points you to changing practices over time, even well after ratification. So I think the argument is strongest there. Maybe it's unassailable there. The question is whether you think that there's still some gap-filling role that tradition can or should play in other cases as well. And as far as I can think of, none of the separation of powers cases that rely on tradition have a serious argument that the original meaning of the clause tells you to do that. It's just a way of handling how sparse the text is and often how sparse the ratification debates about the provision are. and you want courts to be able to point to something other than their own policy judgments of constitutional design to say that this is or isn't permissible. As I said, in most cases, you can also flip that and justify it in totally different terms. It's just a kind of deference to the political actors. The set of cases where I think it's hardest to do that and impossible to rely on an originalist argument are the cases where the court says, because this branch has never done this, it lacks the power to do it. Because there, you're not deferring to any deliberate choice on the part of political actors. And there's no necessary reason to think that the failure of the branch to do this in the past reflects a judgment about what the text means. It might just be that they never had an occasion to do it in the past. It might be that they didn't think it was expedient. It might be that they didn't think there was a need. So maybe, you know, compelling commerce in the name of regulating it was just not necessary before the current economic conditions. So it's in that set of cases where I think the argument is weakest.
All right, well, we'll give it another minute, and I think everyone in the audience can get ready for your own questions. So please get prepared, be thinking of some good ones. In the meantime, I'll ask you, Professor Sachs, one question that I had, and I think you answered it a little bit procedurally, was how do you account for potentially a democratic legitimacy deficit in the early states where maybe on a particular issue it's seen, I can think of a few examples, of issues where it seemed that it just wasn't going to happen, but it was politically expedient for a particular governor to say to some activists, you know what, your concerns are very important, so we're going to pass this, you know, we're going to ask for this amendment, and thanks for playing. Whereas once the issue gets steam, then there would be a bigger discussion. Now, you say that you can limit that procedurally. Would your limits have to be part of the constitutional amendment process, or could those be legislatively enacted on a specific question?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it would just be how it plays out in practice. So the worry, I think, would be, imagine there's some issue on which this, it's very politically salient, but the proposal that sort of activist groups settle on is just terribly drafted. And then the snowball builds, mm-hmm. and it's sort of too hard to change the drafting later. Like, that would be the worry. But I think, honestly, the same thing happens in Congress with some regularity. And one advantage is that, you know, okay, so you've got five states that are the early adopters that are, you know, going ahead. I mean, I'm sure that it's the case. So I'm sure that you would see, like, 12 states would immediately pass the Codify Roe Amendment. And, you know, 12 states would immediately pass the Fetal Personhood Amendment. And then, you know, you just sort of see how it would play out. But of course, you know, Congress and all the other states are still there. They haven't disappeared from the equation. So if there's a movement that gets to, you know, 20 odd states, and we're like, oh, this is actually a thing now, you might expect somebody in Congress who would love to have their name on television to, you know, jump out in front and say, like, oh, I've got my version of that amendment now. And so, like, the language will be worked on. It won't just be that sort of whatever starts in the first three states, you know, carries through forever. So I see that as just the sort of thing that the political process will work out in an attempt to get agreement across a whole lot of states or a whole lot of members of Congress. They will do whatever hashing out they need to do.
Speaking of procedures, Professor Lessig, you mentioned some procedures that in some policies that, in your view, could be put in place to avoid what we've called a runaway convention. Do you think that those procedures would stand up constitutionally as a matter of kind of amending the amendment process without a constitutional amendment? Do you think that Congress has the ability or a convention has the ability to limit itself in that way without those parameters being within the Constitution?
I certainly think that a convention must have rules, and those rules can constrain what the convention can do. And there's a hot debate about whether Congress is the source of those rules or the state legislatures themselves. The process that's going on right now is the state legislatures are basically trying to tee up the acceptable set of rules that Congress could ratify, and we don't have to figure out who's actually the source of authority here. But those rules, I think, at least practically bind the convention. And I think this is the point that law professors sometimes find hard to grapple with. Like, what is the practical constraint? Not the theoretical constraint. So, you know, go back to this question of imagine Congress does what I said. They said 60% or they say a referendum that happens. I mean, just think practically of what happens to that amendment, right? I mean, you know, immediately it's litigated. Immediately the Supreme Court's got to decide whether it's going to say this is constitutional or not. When it says this is not constitutional, a whole bunch of governmental actors have to then decide, what are they going to do? Are they going to obey the court, like that says that you can't draw money from the Treasury to advance this? And my sense is, practically, that's a huge constraint. Like that, if you really are at the place where we could imagine people rising up and stopping the whole infrastructure of our current government, then we do have a revolution on our hands. In 1787, of course, there was no Supreme Court that could look at what the Articles, what had happened to the Articles of Confederation, say anything about it. So I think that the practical structures that you build get you 90% the way of like being confident it's not gonna, there's not gonna be a runaway. Indeed, this is what frustrates me about Common Cause. I want there to be a convention that's able to consider changes to, you know, what I think of as representational integrity. Fiscal integrity is what the balanced budget amendment's about, but representational integrity, whether it's money in politics or term limits or gerrymandering, whatever, that's a range of issues that I think we seriously have to consider. But because of the efforts of Common Cause to get these movements for campaign finance to rescind themselves, I think there will be a convention. It will only be able to consider balanced budget, maybe term limits, which is increasingly passing. And it won't be able to consider any of the issues that I think one side of the political spectrum think are important, which will render the convention a partisan convention, which is sufficient to make anything that it produces dead on arrival in the state legislatures. I think 13 states will immediately repeal them, which means that the whole effort will have been lost to try to achieve some kind of amending process that can rise above the pathology of the current political divide.
Thank you. All right. Do we have questions?
Howdy, everybody. My name is Sean Anderson. I'm from Notre Dame. And so my question is for Professor Lessig. So at the Constitutional Convention, the common law was much less positivistic than it is now, and thus reliant on pre-constitutional Anglo-American legal traditions. But now that the common law is much more positivistic and thus reliant on statutes and the Constitution as written, how do you envision our body of case law surviving both a more controlled convention or a more comprehensive or so-called runaway convention? Thank you.
Well, I mean, I could imagine Steve would like succeed in reestablishing the general federal common law at this convention. At this convention. It's conceivable that there could be a fundamental change in our post-Erie conception insisted upon by such a convention. But I actually think when you look at the particular amendments people are proposing, they're kind of orthogonal to the underlying conception of the law, right? So will we have term limits? It doesn't really matter what your conception of the law is to know whether, you know, how that would be enforced. Would we change the rule that Citizens United articulates about the inability of Congress to regulate spending? I don't think Citizens United says it can't regulate contributions, but that's another argument. So I think that many of the issues we have right now have evolved to a place where we don't need to struggle with that much. Now, where Steve's work, Steve and colleagues, Jed and Will's work has been really valuable is thinking in the 14th Amendment context of how do we understand the source of law that should inform what I think we all conceive of as a richer conception of privileges or immunities, at least. And that's an interesting place for that kind of debate. I would predict, we would settle on a kind of Scalia-esque view about the Erie question, which is, you know, that's settled, stop talking about, you know, this old way of thinking about the law. But, you know, the Scalia professor might actually succeed in reversing Scalia on that particular point.
Yes, right here.
Thank you. My name is Lily Pearson from Regent University. It's an honor to hear from all of you. My question is for Professor Gurgis, and would you just help us to explain or help us understand the compatibility of traditionalism as you explain it with original public meaning textualism?
Yeah, so it's complicated. It's a complicated relationship. The easiest cases are the ones that Professor Sachs was mentioning, where the original meaning tells you to look to traditions. So you're being a good originalist by being a traditionalist, by looking to the changing practices. And John Stinnefort has made that argument. The case where it's easiest to see prima facie, and then John Stinnefort has developed the historical arguments, is on the Eighth Amendment. What does cruel and unusual mean? It means punishments that have fallen out of use for long enough. So that makes them unusual. And once that's true, it becomes unlawful. All right. Those are the easy cases. What about cases where the text doesn't clearly point you to traditions? One account would be, well, we're originalists, but because original public meaning trumps when it's clear. But when it's not clear, we have to go to something else. And sometimes we can go to judicial precedents, and sometimes we can go to the non-judicial precedents where political actors actually hashed out a legal issue. And sometimes we don't have either of those things. And we have this practice of going to other kinds of practices. So we'll go to those next. And that's at least better than the alternatives of the judge making their own independent policy or value judgment about what the outcome of the case should be. There's another way of thinking of it where, as I mentioned, you could think, well, the reason we should go to that next is just out of a kind of democratic impulse, like the overall structure and point of our system is underlain by popular sovereignty. And so where the judge doesn't have a clear mandate in a super majoritarian provision or set of practices, they should defer to the practices of the political actors. So I think the one case where I'm quite confident there's no good originalist argument for relying on it is in the set of cases where the court, as I mentioned earlier, is saying, because this has never been done, because this actor or branch has never done taken a certain action, it lacks the power to take that action. Or at least to make that a good originalist argument, you need to rule out the possibility that it didn't take that action for completely separate reasons. So just to make it exciting as you're all falling asleep, on Section 3 disqualification case from this week, the court says the states lack the constitutional power to enforce Section 3 against candidates for federal office because they've never exercised that power. And what I would want to know is that the best explanation of why they didn't exercise it? Just that they didn't think they had the power to. What if it turns out that they didn't have to exercise it against candidates for Congress because everybody knew that each house would police its own qualifications for office, and that's exactly what happened? They didn't have to exercise it against candidates for the presidency or vice presidency because that didn't become a live issue, partly because those are way fewer. The number of candidates are way fewer, partly because Congress very soon passed this amnesty legislation that basically cleared everybody of complicity with the Civil War in general. And if those are the best explanations of why there's no record of states enforcing this against federal officials, then I don't think that record provides any inference to the conclusion that the states just thought they lacked that power.
You can all notice that I have a great subconscious appreciation for your questions, because ordinarily I have to say, make sure you remember that this is the question section, not the comment section. So the first two questioners did a great job of living up to my apparent enthusiasm. So I know that everyone else will too. Let's see, I saw a few hands over here, please.
Hi, my name's Luke DeWeese. I'm from Penn State. I started law school with a little training in the civil law tradition. And in that tradition, it's often said as one of the axioms of law that custom is the best interpreter of law. And it's always struck me as interesting that I don't see how any legal system can function as long as ours has without allowing just the traditional behavior of people who actually are in power to fill in the gap when the text of the written law code seems to be silent. So if any of you could speak to the question of why does that axiom from ancient Roman law that custom is the best interpreter of the law, why hasn't it really seeped down into American law?
Can I ask, I actually want to say something that's going to agree with, I think, your sentiment here and actually follow up on the really great question before. I think one of the reasons is we've lost a recognition of like what that customary practice is, because we don't live it. And instead, we live in this post-Erie kind of positivist reality. And that's one of the reasons people, are so terrified about, for example, an Article 5 convention, because they have no conception of what would be constraining it, except these written rules. And we all know we could always be abolishing these written rules. David Posen's done a lot of recent work about reviving the customs that really constrained the many constitutional conventions to amend constitutions that occurred at the founding period, not just our federal one, but state conventions. And I have the sense that if you were like Steve and you embodied these norms as like a general practice every day as you woke up and thought through how the general law constrains everything you're doing, it wouldn't seem so scary to be engaging in these kinds of activities. But it's because we're in this moment where we think the only thing is the thing written on paper, and we don't have anything written on paper about Article 5 conventions. We're so terrified about that practice.
So I appreciate the description of me, you know, getting up in the morning, making my oatmeal, and brooding omnipresently. But I would say that the reason is, and it's an interesting feature of the American legal system, that our fundamental law is, to a very large extent, enacted. And so we think that it was adopted at a particular time with particular content, and if we're doing something else, we must be getting it wrong. One way to illustrate this is there are a lot of different ways that custom can interpret law. So take what in other countries would be regarded as constitutional conventions. So one example might be the president can't run more than twice. And that was a convention and people stuck to it. You know, are you better than George Washington? You know, and so for a very long time, nobody would run for more than two terms. And then FDR comes along and the custom is violated and we think, okay, we gotta have some written law now. We're actually gonna hard code that one. Whereas before, we could just depend on it being custom. There are a lot of things that people do by custom in ways that we don't think create law. So judges wear black robes. There's no law requiring federal judges to do so. There is such a law in Florida because they had a judge who showed up to work in camo robes and they thought that was a little indecent, might be injudicious. They said, okay, they gotta be black. Otherwise we can just sort of get along with this custom. Now that's a rule of official practice that there would be sanction for violating it, but it is not a rule of law. It's a distinct kind of rule that governs how this particular official does their job. And so when we're trying to figure out, well, can Congress recognize foreign states? They have to regulate commerce with those states, so presumably they have to know whether those states exist or not. But can the president recognize foreign states? The president can send and receive ambassadors. They got to know whether this is a real country or not. Who gets to do this? And there might be areas where the enacted rule is unclear. But also the custom that has grown up doesn't necessarily tell us anything about the content of the enacted rule. And it might well be that if now Congress wants to do something else different from the president, we might have to decide who wins. And it might be hard for us just to say, this is the custom, because it's not so much interpreting the law as adding to it or supplanting it in various ways.
Right here in the bearded gentleman.
Good evening, I'm Jack Sarah from my office in the law. I appreciate your offer of the ability to ask a question. A lot of my concern is very similar and tangential to the last two questions. Analogizing to the way we think about separation of powers to English legal law, between the sort of like Norman and the Tudor era, you didn't have this date of nature, you didn't have a Hobbesian conception of individuals. But you had a sort of like genuine multiplicity of all the work. So you had the king and his cabinet, religious institutions that governed the union of families, and then you had the family. And the family, created a community, and by that community created an honor. And that sense of honor is aforementioned morals and the customs that developed out of family and out of home. And that was taken into consideration by the courts. Today, we have a modern understanding of government where we say there's unitary authority, the state's apparatus, and then hedge against that, we'll create separation of powers by making the state apparatus individual. So we'll have different branches. So I guess my real question is, the way that we frame this, why not play sort of a different game in crafting institutions to achieve a genuine multiplicity instead of playing a rigged game where you have a unitary form of valid authority and then you just divide that and separate the powers that are in between different branches?
So I don't know if this is a fully responsive answer, but in some ways, that's already what we're doing, in the sense that, maybe not in the right way, but certainly when you read, Federalist 10, you're trying to figure out, there's going to be some powers that are going to be exercised by public authorities. How should they be parceled out? Are there ways for, a republic to have all these different factions in it that are going to be fighting with one another? And can we figure out a way of doing that so that it promotes liberty and promotes things that we would want, as opposed to lurching from one tyranny to the next? It's not easy to do. The idea of ambition counteracting ambition doesn't always work the same way. I think it's is it Rick Pildes who has the separation of parties, not powers argument, that sort of the House is not jealous of its privileges in the way that it used to be, whereas the parties very much are, and maybe different arrangements would be better to match the kinds of dissensions that we now have. But certainly one thing I can say is that, the multiplicity of power centers was not necessarily conducive to stability, as English legal history from the Normans to the Tudors might reveal. So I don't know if we've got it better than they did for all of our problems today. I don't know what you guys would say.
Look way in the back.
Gene Meyer, one thing I've wondered about is, we have, for example, the 27th Amendment. There was a process problem, clearly, with the vice president. What do you do in that situation? You got together, we solved it because there was a widespread agreement, and nobody's ox was being particularly gored. Why does the panel think that on amendments going to sort of, let's just say, decrease polarization and make people feel more a part of the process when they possibly are feeling shut out because now there's a constitutional amendment passed by essentially a somewhat smaller majority that completely blocks them?
I'll start. Maybe it's just naive, but I feel like the things that could pass would unite and surprise people. I think, for example, in the field that I work in, campaign finance, there's actually very strong cross-partisan agreement about the problems with the existing system. And those problems will not be addressed by the existing system. You're not going to see Congress taking up an amendment to deal with this, promises of reform organizations notwithstanding. Another one might be, given the partisan character of Congress, the framers' conception of advice and consent for nominations just makes no sense. Because whereas in the framing context and for most of the history of our nation, presidents would propose the government they want, and 95% of them would be confirmed extremely quickly. Now we have this game where we have to run, presidents have to run governments for years without having the positions filled. There too, you don't see the parties proposing this kind of change because each party is jealous of its own ability to leverage that power. But if you had a process where, in fact, such a change were made, I don't think that the people actually would share Congress's conception about the need to maintain its veto authority over executive. So I feel like the things that would filter through this process, especially if it were a convention process or Steve's process, especially if it were complemented by assemblies around it, would begin to identify those few areas where in this partisan culture we actually have some important consensus. And that would be surprising to most people, because most people, you know, believe that we have no possible consensus on anything of substance.
Yes.
I'm Ivan from Colombia, and I have a question about Article 5. And if I recall correctly, Professor Akil Amar wrote an article about, like, he thinks we the people have an unenumerated right to call for a constitutional convention outside of Article 5, perhaps under the Ninth Amendment. And I wonder, like, whether you agree or disagree with this proposal. Thank you.
I do not agree. You can certainly find a lot of founding era history discussion of the people's right to alter their government. I think that it matters a lot whether that is a right of revolution and sort of a political theory right. We think it is politically legitimate and binding in conscience for people to change the government in the following way, or a legal claim about a specific set of arrangements, namely, under the Constitution as enacted, the Constitution of 1788, is this move okay? And those are just two fundamentally different questions to me. And so, you know, I don't think that the Constitution necessarily binds in conscience. You know, I think that should be a relatively straightforward fact. It had a fugitive slave clause in it for a long time. That was not binding in conscience. Nonetheless, it was the law. And so, you know, I see those two things as coming apart more often than we would like. And so I think that, you know, Article 5 is the law. I think that it prescribes what is a legal move within this system, but it does not and cannot tell us what is morally appropriate for us to do outside that system, which might involve some other kind of mode of constitutional change.
I actually think, so I was Akil's student, and I think I'm a better student of Akil's than, I don't know if you were his student, but I actually think it's—
I think we all were, perhaps.
Yeah.
As his student.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, but I begin my own book on constitutional theory, Fidelity and Strength, with this problem, because I think it's extremely illustrative. The precise way to frame it, I think, is would the framers have viewed Article 5 as exclusive? And I think it's completely plausible that against the background of understanding, sociological understanding at the time, they wouldn't have read it as exclusive. I also think it's absolutely clear that today, no sane lawyer would look at Article 5 and say it's not exclusive. You know, they might have been, you know, the few who go to the Yale Law School might sort of have been like abused into a different thought by Akil, because he is very abusive and persuasive both. But most people would look at it and say, yeah, this is exclusive. What are you talking about? That's the only way to amend the Constitution. But that's what's so interesting. The fact that a background presumption evolves, and it's the same with the common law or the general law, I think, has real significance for an interpreter. And how one makes sense of it is not an obvious question, but it is a question that we need to find a way to surface more systematically and address in a more principled way that I think at least law professors thinking about it have.
Yes, right there in the middle. We're hoping you get your steps in.
Please hold it. Hi, my name is Jake. I'm coming from McGill University, and I must apologize because my question is slightly parochial, but I want to ask it anyways. So in my home country, there's a taboo against opening the Constitution. The reason being, after 1982, when we brought in the Charter, there was a series of attempts to amend the Constitution that led to Quebec attempting to leave Canada twice. So my question is, if there is a convention of the states, and you have an agreement that only 38 of the states agree to, let's say, do you worry that that could have deleterious effects on the Union? Thank you.
I mean, honestly, that's one reason why the 3/4 rule might not be such a terrible thing. you know, it's very easy to say, like, my gosh, this is undemocratic. Look how, you know, hard it is to get constitutional amendments. But then you remember the constitutional amendments can say anything. And I mean, they could reimpose slavery. They could repeal the First Amendment. They could, abolish the family. They can do whatever it is you don't want. And so you have to say, like, okay, given that fact, we would be very worried about having a narrowly adopted constitutional amendment that might make the dissenting states say, sorry, we're out of here. And so certainly, like, one of the arguments for thinking that it might have been the exclusive mode, you know, early on, is that a lot of states, you know, did not want they didn't want to sign on to something that said, as soon as 50% plus one vote the other way, they have now changed the deal. That is definitely a worry. There's a reason to be cautious about changing the fundamentals of government. That's one of the reasons why I don't support lowering the threshold very much. But I do think that, you know, it might be good for us to do that more than have, you know, five justices think they're being called to be statesmen and start doing things that are hard to reconcile with the existing constitutional order, because that too can, you know, taken to sufficient extremes, cause people to say, sorry, we're out of here.
Yes.
Hi, I'm Gabe Lopez here from Columbia Law School. My question is for Professor Sachs. Under your system where the states move first, if states adopt fundamentally the same idea but with slightly different variations of language, would it then go to Congress for language finalization, or would they all have to reapprove the exact same language continuously before it goes to Congress?
I think that the better approach is to require them to adopt the same language. Now, maybe as with the ratification of the 16th Amendment, Scrivener's errors could be overlooked. Although, if you're active in the sovereign citizen movement, you're probably aware that there are folks who think that they can't be. My sense is that basically the states should have to agree on the proposal, just like both houses of Congress have to agree on the same proposal. It can't be, you know, they say 6 years, we say five, close enough. It's got to be the same proposal that is being enacted by all these entities.
It looks like we're getting toward the end of the questions. If anyone has one, please raise your hand high so I can see you. The lights are bright in here. There we go.
Joe Meng, Chicago Law. I wondered if Professor Lessig could talk more about the political safeguards against a runaway convention. I know it's been discussed a little bit, but when it just come down to five justices saying, hey, I really like this idea, but the Constitution comes first, especially given how recently we've seen how very bold political theories can garner attraction to people who benefit quite a bit from it politically.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's been a lot of great work about the actual practical political constraints on runaway in both senses of exceeding the scope of a limited convention and also in the Robert Reich sense. And I think the biggest is just what we could think of as the 13-state veto. I think that if you see a convention violating its terms expressly, there would be a strong move, maybe not sufficient, because maybe we are in a revolutionary moment, but a strong move to say, forget it, we're finished with you and what you've done, because you violated these rules. We need to have an ability to believe that the limits on our convention will be respected. And even if we like the amendment, or even if the amendment is something that we could persuade ourselves we'd like, there's a reason to step back from it because of the violation of the rules. I don't think that there's a judicial, there won't be a judicial constraint on this. For a lot of reasons, but I just think that the only way to do it is to motivate the political constraint. And if we could get a genuinely cross-partisan convention movement, or even the movement for what Steve is describing, reflection on both sides will lead people to accept that if we're going to have this new mode of making sure we have an opportunity to amend the Constitution without five justices doing it for us, then we need to do it in a disciplined way. I think that would tend to reinforce a political constraint to make it not something to fear.
All right. Going once?
There's one right there.
Oh, good. Okay, great.
Hi, my name's Julia. I am a student at this law school. Thank you very much for being here. So my understanding is that state constitutions are often much more easily amended than the federal constitution, and that that has not resulted in any particular disaster. So I am open to being proven wrong on that as a historical matter. Do you think there is something special about states that make them they can survive having much more easily amendable constitutions as opposed to the federal government? And if so, what is that special quality or characteristic?
Much smaller militaries. Which I mean entirely seriously. It is totally possible for Rhode Island to go to hell and the Dur Rebellion happen and like there be fighting in the streets and the Republic in some larger sense does not fall, because as soon as the president or Congress sort of tip their hand, it's immediately obvious who's going to win. And so there's a sort of automatic constraint on how badly things can go within a single state. You see like state level court packing, you see like all kinds of crazy procedural shenanigans in state constitutional conventions, and like just fundamentally social order does not break down. I don't think we have that same safeguard when it's the federal government doing it. And I think, you know, the history of the Civil War is a good example of that. I don't know if you guys would agree.
Gregory Fasteliotis, Texas A&M. Something that's kind of been underneath this entire discussion is that we need to change the Constitution. Why do we need to change the Constitution? Like, what are we changing in the Constitution?
Well, I mean, I've given, for example, one about appointments. I think that there's a representational deficit inside of our Constitution. And I don't mean just campaign finance. I mean, just generally, if the framers conceived of giving us a republic which entailed equal citizenship, we have lots of mechanisms that have been evolved for denying at least a modern conception of what equal citizenship should require. I think there's reasons to imagine constitutionalizing some of those so that we can have a representative democracy that's actually representative. And that's true. That problem exists in, you know, much more dramatically at the state level. So I think there's been great work pointing out that though the Supreme Court views state legislatures as being in some sense the most pure form of representative democracy, they are in fact among the least. Minority rule is common in many states. And so I think I would be pushing for affirming this principle of representational integrity. There is the strongest movement for amending pushes the principle of fiscal integrity. You know, between today and Juneteenth, there will be $1 trillion added to the federal deficit. $1 trillion in 100 days. So I would think you kids at least should be very anxious about the system that's producing us perpetually borrowing from you and never paying you back. And so I think that there's a lot of, you know, and that's obviously not something people on the left care much about. They care more about representational than fiscal integrity. But I think these two integrity movements should at least have a forum to begin to articulate what principles might we find 38 states to agree upon. And I think we would find some, and I think that would be extremely important to remind people that the Constitution is not the sole is the sole tool for a court, you know, because that's basically how people think of our Constitution today. It's just a thing the Supreme Court interprets, as opposed to the thing that comes from a political process that we all, in some sense, have some relation to.
And if I could add to that, it would be to the extent that you are an originalist and want judges to be more originalist than they are, you're probably going to want them to start striking down a lot of stuff that people like, or to start taking away things that people thought they had that they like. And so the harder it is to amend the Constitution, the harder it is to expect the Supreme Court to do its job well on this understanding of what the Supreme Court's job entails. And so it might be useful to be able to say, gosh, if you actually want that to be in the Constitution, here's a plausible way for you to go get it. So it doesn't necessarily mean that our Constitution has to end up looking very different than current practice, but it might look very different than current constitutional law as correctly understood.
Yes.
Oh. Hi, Hari Suri, Columbia Law. First of all, thank you all. My question is to Professor Gerges, specifically in terms of tradition changing separation of powers doctrine, does that mean we need to accept the New Deal administrative state, even though there's an argument to be made that we've had a tradition of that, but that it goes against, you know, founding notion errors of separated and divided powers. So how do we sort of reckon with that is my question.
Yeah, that's a good question. If you're an originalist who thinks the original meaning trumps and you think you've got a good argument on original meaning grounds that there's a principle of non-delegation or something like that, then you've got an easy answer, which is just the original meaning trumps and it stands in judgment over our changing practices rather than being subject to override by them. But let's suppose that you think it's ambiguous. Let's suppose you think that whether there's a non-delegation doctrine, if that's the aspect of the administrative, of the New Deal that we're gonna focus on, whether there is such a doctrine as rooted in the Constitution as original meaning or structure is ambiguous, then I think there is some argument that that ship has sailed. That if you think that in cases of ambiguity, post-ratification practices count, first of all, if you think that they count even in the cases I've been talking about where there's not a lot of deliberate debate over the constitutional question, we just sort of slide into a practice and then later the court ratifies it, then a fortiori, when there has been tons of more or less extensive debate about whether this is constitutionally permissible, the fact that we've lived with it anyway, and that we've settled on this course of practice anyway, will carry a significant amount of weight. So this is one way in which what, for example, Professor Bruce Ackerman calls constitutional moments. This is a view on which it's not the lightning bolt moment in time that matters. It's the sort of evolving and more or less settled practices over a long time that matters. But it's one way in which something other than a constitutional amendment and other than a single hashing out of a judicial precedent can come to fill in the gaps that, by hypothesis for this part of the answer, exist on whether the New Deal is lawful.
All right. I think you'll be our last customer.
Thank you. My name's Eric. I'm from St. John's Law School. So one of the arguments for judicial review in Marbury was basically that the Constitution gives the judiciary power, the judiciary swears an oath to it, and therefore it has to support the Constitution over ordinary law. So under that theory, if there was a constitutional convention that potentially didn't follow its own rules and procedures, would it even be legitimate for the court to inquire into whether the ratified amendment was legitimate in the first place? I'm thinking specifically of the Luther v. Borden case where the Supreme Court said that the Supreme Court can't determine the validity of a state government because state governments give validity to the Supreme Court itself.
Well, I think it depends on what the character of the amendment and the violation is. So, you know, in my hypothetical, Second Amendment is abolished through a national referendum. So Congress then passes a law that regulates guns in a way that's clearly inconsistent with the core understanding of what the Second Amendment is. And then the question the court would answer is whether that law is law or not. And under Marbury conception, I think it would say, we don't see the Second Amendment erased from our Constitution, it's still there. And we're going to apply that Second Amendment as it's been evolved, not to just, I think it was originally understood to constrain the federal government, to say that, no, you can't ban the possession of guns consistent with the Second Amendment. And this interesting story about a referendum is a nice way to build a political movement. Go build your political movement to amend the Constitution. But you haven't amended the Constitution because we can see in Article 5, plain law says it only is amended if 38 states have adopted the amendment, and that didn't happen in my hypothetical.
I think, though, that that places a lot of faith in the Supreme Court to be applying the pre-existing law and not to say something revolutionary has just happened. And that, you know, our Constitution didn't provide for this kind of referendum, but you know what? It got referendumed. And that as a result, we now have, you know, a new polity in some limited way.
Yeah, they could say there's a new referendum, but you're really imagining a pretty radical move for the court to say, and that referendum has changed the words of Article 5 outside of the scope of the terms of Article 5. I mean, that would be a revolution, you know, and God knows we're all anxious about the revolutionary moment we feel like we're at. But I, you know, from my sense of what the court is, I don't see the court saying that. The court might say, do what you will. We're going to write an opinion that says the Second Amendment is still the law. But I don't think the court's going to say, oh, yeah, we're following the French. There's now a new constitution because the referendum has been passed by Congress.
All right. Well, with that, a really interesting set of questions, I thank our wonderful panelists for really heady, interesting discussion.
That was great. Yeah.